Good morning, good morning, good morning.
Good morning.
Traveling and drinking.
There you go. That's a good start.
Oh, tell us about who are we interviewing today, Rabbit?
Well, we have a author of a great new cookbook called Carol Walter who's coming up, and then we're going down under again, and this time we're going to the great state of Victoria. I guess that's what they always say down there. One of the oldest settled areas of Australia, and a particularly interesting section just outside the city of Melbourne called the Yarra Valley, where we found a wonderful place to stay and three great winemakers to talk to.
And it was fun. That was real fun.
So that ought to make a pretty good program for you, don't you think?
Yes, let's get started. Let's get rolling.
Welcome, Carol Walter, to On the Menu. Hello, Carol.
How are you this morning?
Well, I'm just fine. Listeners are going to run out and grab this book when they get a whiff of this, called Great Coffee Cakes, Sticky Buns, Muffins, and More. And it is, I mean, you were so respected in the field, and it's a big wide field of baking writers and teachers. But I looked at the back of this book, and you have kudos from every single major figure, including Dory Greenspan, who's an icon in her own right.
Oh, Dory's wonderful. Oh,
her book is one of my keepers. I mean, it's just fabulous. We already interviewed her on the menu. Gail Gand is another one. Nick Malgeri we've interviewed twice, and his books are wonderful. And Shirley Corer. I mean, the tributes are wonderful. And basically what they're all saying is your recipes really work.
Well, I try very hard to make them work. I keep testing and testing, and my recipes are very thoroughly written. I try to write instructions in there so that I am sort of at your side when you're baking. The recipes may seem long, but in actuality, to explain what to look for, that's necessary.
Yeah, you're coaching everybody through each of these recipes.
Yes.
Now, this is not your first adventure at a cookbook, though, Carol, correct?
Absolutely not. It's my fourth major book.
And what a lot of work with testing all these recipes. And
how long does it take from start to finish? I mean, some people seem to have one good book in a lifetime. You've done four already, but how long does each one take?
Well, a lot of years went by.
Oh, I see.
Now, studied in the United States, France, Austria, Italy, Denmark with famous pastry chefs.
Yes. I went to Europe several times to research recipes, to watch production, watch the bakers. I don't need the recipes, the actual recipes. I visually just watch what's going on. I take notes, and then I do my own thing when I get back to the United States.
Now that's pretty smart, huh?
Well, I'll tell you, I was privileged to be in some of the finest patisseries in Europe, and I learned so very much from all of that. I did work in some of them, hands-on.
Anything standing out?
And then some places I just took notes. It depended upon where I went.
Now, which country would you say, of all the ones you've been to, has the best pastry tradition, Carol?
Well, it's Austria.
Austria. That's what I was going to say. Although I guess that would cause the Franco-Prussian War to start all over again, wouldn't it?
Well, let me tell you. I think a lot of people don't realize that all of these pastries evolved from that area, Italy, Scandinavia. If you know your history at all, the way the wars went in. Centuries, the way the wars went, people traveled from Turkey into Austria and that part of Europe, and then they went down toward Italy. Danish pastry was really created by a chef from Austria that went to Denmark and showed them how to make leavened bread, sweet bread. It's very interesting. France, I mean, the history with Catherine de' Medici from Italy. She went to France, and with her she took all her chefs, and that's sort of how it all evolved. And to this day, I still think the most exciting pastries came out of Austria. And the, all the countries make wonderful pastries. But I think what I saw in Austria probably excited me the most, because I think that's sort of where it started.
Uh-huh. And they certainly are known for this. Now, I'm looking at your table of contents.
Yeah.
Perfect pound cakes, home-style coffee cakes, muffins and quick breads, biscuits and scones, easy does it yeasted coffee cakes, which you had some comments about, which we'll get back to in a minute, a brioche croissant and Danish strudel, then and now, which I'm going to ask you about.
Yes.
Yeah, then coffee break bites, then streusels, glazes, frostings, and spreads. Then you tell everybody about the equipment, ingredients, techniques. It's a very thorough book in this subject, and it's a subject, I think, that's going to have a lot of people drooling. People love this. Why do people love this kind of baked goods?
I think it's comfort. Comfort is a word that's used a lot, but that's exactly what it's about. It's the type of pastry you can eat most any hour of the day. Grab a cup of coffee and you want something sweet to satisfy you. And any one of the things that you mentioned would work. You can make them, you know, a little more elaborate if you wish, but it's the kind of pastry that you just, or cakes, that you just like to keep around the house if people drop in for brunch.
Yeah, I remember my mother always had something, if nothing but a pound cake, in case anybody came by.
Well, you have no idea how much people love pound cakes, and the book has a number of wonderful pound cakes. Pound cakes can be a little challenging, and I think the recipes that I've created here are really, really wonderful. There are really some excellent ones. I've got a marble pound cake, a very basic one. I make the recipe, the cakes with, many of them with, confectioner sugar, and, confectioner sugar gives a marvelous light velvety texture to the cake, and, pound cakes freeze beautifully. A lot of the recipes that I have in this book are recipes that can be frozen, cakes that can be frozen, or pastries. And that's a great advantage. It really is for people on the run. The one section that I had mentioned to you about the Easy Does It Easy Coffee Cakes.
Why did they go away?
This was based on a couple of recipes that were floating around during the 1950s. I think almost every family that I visited had their favorite, what they called at that time, yeast cake. Just yeast cake. And we all knew what it was. Whether it was, I know my parents lived in North Carolina. They had their yeast cake. They certainly had it in the metropolitan area where I live, in the New York, New Jersey area, Ohio, West Coast. I mean, this was something that was commonly baked, and for some reason it just died. And I resurrected this type of recipe, a basic recipe that you can make cinnamon buns, crumb buns. You can do babka. You can do, I have a fig and walnut cake.
Oh, that looks really good.
There are just so many things. I created something called a blueberry pizza from this basic recipe. And they're so easy to make. And what I've done was work the recipe out so that you can actually shape the dough and have it in your freezer in a foil container ready to bake, which is wonderful. It is a refrigerated dough. You make it in a mixer, or you can do it by hand if you don't have an electric mixer. But the ingredients are put together in the mixer. There's no kneading. You just make the dough, put it in the refrigerator. The next day, divide it into pieces, shape it, and you can freeze it all ready to bake. Or you can just have the dough made and divide it up and in discs and have it in your freezer like you would a pie crust, for argument's sake.
Now, your photographs are absolutely delicious.
Directions for thawing are very simple. You just let it warm up to room temperature, shape it, and bake it. And so you can do it either way. But baking in foil containers for this type of cake, believe it or not, worked beautifully. And I'm a believer of good baking utensils. But this has worked. And it is wonderful to be able to go to your freezer and pull out, let's say, some crumb buns in a pan ready to bake. And you just thaw it at room temperature till it rises. And off it goes into the oven, and the smells are, oh, heaven. And when it comes out of the oven, you've got wonderful crumb buns that you can just eat. That's a pull-apart. You just put these little balls in a pan and put a streusel topping on it, let it rise.
I love that streusel
topping.
And
I guarantee you, impossible to resist.
It's impossible
to pull these recipes together from the past and introduce some new ideas of my own.
Now,
so that's what that chapter is about.
Carol?
And you wanted to ask me about then and now?
I wanted to ask you also, what's the difference between a muffin and a cupcake?
Muffin and a cupcake. Well, in some recipes, they could be very similar, but muffins are more like a quick bread batter. You don't beat it as much. Muffins generally have quite a bit of leavening in them, and they're not as rich. They're very often topped with a crumb topping or a little bit of sugar, or sometimes a little webbed glaze can go over the top, but they don't have a real rich, thick frosting on them, and they're not as sweet. The cupcakes are much sweeter.
Carol, you're also a big proponent of marbling. Now, why is that?
Because I think people adore anything that is marbled. There's kind of a curiosity. I have found throughout my years of teaching, when something is marbled, there's a... great interest is the wrong word. I think it's a curiosity, and they tend to always pick up something that's marbled when it's on a buffet table, regardless of, I mean, a pound cake or any type of cake that has that marbling effect through it is always very pretty, and I think they like the combination of you. It's generally chocolate and vanilla. It doesn't have to be, but generally the chocolate and vanilla has great appeal, and they're very pretty. There is a real technique to marbling.
Now, just for those dummies like this dummy gentleman listeners like myself, let's just make sure that we understand that marbling is when you have a cake that's different colors all blended together.
Yes,
okay.
It's, as I said, it's usually chocolate and vanilla, but you can marble pink and green in a batter, you know, if you were making something for children. But the most popular combination by far is chocolate and vanilla. And when you marble, you have to realize that when you layer batters, very often the type of batter has to be a more thick or dense batter to create a really good marbling effect. If the batter is very loose, you're going to get not as clearly defined lines for marbling. The best thing to do is to have, if you're going to marble, and generally speaking, recipes for cakes are written, you know, as a marble cake, although some people like to try to do it on their own. But I have found that many of the recipes don't address the fact that cakes rise from the outside first. So it's best when you're layering to put a larger amount of vanilla batter on the bottom, even sometimes as much as halfway, half the amount of batter goes in first, and then you start to layer the chocolate with smaller layers of vanilla. And the reason for that is chocolate batters are generally heavy and they sink, so that if you put them in the pan too close to the bottom, they will all the batter will mostly be chocolate on the bottom. Whereas if you put more vanilla, you've got that buffer zone, so that if the chocolate sinks, you have enough vanilla batter surrounding it to encase the chocolate so it won't all go to the bottom. And as I said before, the reason that happens is because cakes rise from the outside first. So if the batter is rising from the outside, what's in the center drops.
And that's, you know, so
and,
much.
And as, at best, as I said, chocolate batters are generally a little heavier than vanilla. So you will really get a nice marbled effect if you put a little buffer zone in there and put a thicker layer of the vanilla toward the bottom.
Just one of your many, many good tips. You know so much and have so much information to impart, Carol. And I want to call attention to listeners that you have a section for each recipe called At a Glance that tells you the difficulty level of baking it. And you clearly want everybody using this cookbook to succeed.
I've done my best.
You sure have.
The At a Glance was born when I was testing recipes, and at the top of each recipe, I would put my oven temp to kind of pan the baking preparation for the pan, the difficulty, and the baking time. And I started that with my very first book, Great Cakes, many years ago, and it has worked very nicely because you don't have to stop and read the whole recipe to pull out the baking temperature and the kind of pan. It's right up there for you, and that's very, very helpful. And another thing that's happened over the years, which your audience may find of interest, are the head notes that recipes have. Years ago, they didn't pay very much attention to head notes. That's the paragraph that is written before a recipe. They have become so important to the recipe. Not only is there very interesting information, sometimes personal, sometimes whimsical, as they are in my book, but within the head notes, very often it will tell you a little tip, a little hint, if an ingredient is difficult to get in the recipe or where to easily obtain it. I try to stay away from hard-to-get ingredients, and I generally use standardized pans. But sometimes I can point out if an ingredient that I know is especially good, where to shop for it. And so head notes are important, and our listening audience should always remember to read them. And I will tell you, just as another tip, so many people don't read through a recipe before
right,
they
this
make
is
it.
True. That, I mean, I have episodes when I started cooking about that, and then it says, now simmer for 6 hours, and it's already 7 o'clock. Carol, you have so much good information in this book. I'm sure that the readers will use it and enjoy it. And I know you have a lot of baking to do right now, holiday baking. So I'm going to say thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
Oh, and it's been my pleasure.
Yeah, and thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure speaking to both of you, and enjoy our beautiful weather.
Oh, indeed. Thank you, Carol.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
It's time now to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. And
hey, you said it again. You're not supposed to say welcome back all the time.
I know.
Boring.
I just felt like it. And we're going to be moving on from yummy sticky buns to yummy wines.
Yeah, and no real connection between the two, except that although you can drive to the Yarra Valley from Melbourne, it's really not all that far. It's much pleasanter to take the opportunity to stay at a wonderful Relais and Chateau property called Chateau Yearing. So, of course, that's what On the Menu decided to do. So we hide out there, and we enjoy dinner in the evening, and we talked to the chef about what that was all going to be about. And then the following morning, we talked to Sue, who is the general manager of this wonderful establishment, and we're just going to play those back-to-back so that you can have the opportunity to understand what it feels like to stay and eat at Chateau Yearing, in the Yarra Valley, in the great state of Victoria, in Australia.
Matthew McCartney says he's not related to the famous Sir Paul, but he has crossed our lives on the menu without him realizing it and without us realizing it until just now, because he just told me that he spent 8 weeks working with Daniel Ballou in his organization in New York, and we were talking about what his experiences were like there. He said it was a great experience, but just part of the learning of his career up until now. We're at Chateau Yiering, where he's now the head chef. But you've been a few interesting places along the way, Matthew, right?
Yeah, I have. I've spent some time working in different kitchens. I spent a number of years working at a great country restaurant in Australia called The Lake House in Daylesford. It's multi-award winning and has been established for 25 years. And now I find myself in the country again, in the Yarra Valley this time, and enjoying a beautiful property, which is Chateau Yiering, and it's a relais chateau, which is just amazing.
Now, you said you also spent some time in Melbourne. Was that your home, Matthew?
Yes, I'm from Melbourne originally, and I spent time working at the Hotel Sofitel in Melbourne and Cafe Cucina, which is a beautiful little Italian restaurant, also in the city.
Now, give us an idea what kind of food you're trying to offer to visitors to Chateau Yiering. We talked a little bit about local fresh, different techniques. Now, how would you summarize it, Matthew?
I would summarize the style of food we do here at Chateau Yiering as contemporary Australian cuisine, using French technique with some Asian influences, and really sourcing as much local produce as possible and keeping it fresh always.
And you've got quite a larder available to you just in the few miles surrounding Chateau Yiering.
Yes, it's a beautiful cheese district. We have great cheeses and wines. We also have a local pig farmer, which is the black pig, the rarest breed of pig in Australia. And we try to have that on the menu as often as possible. But being a small producer and being in the country, it is challenging sometimes to get some of the small country products on the menu.
Now, the hare ran out and then ran away. I understand, so there was no hare available last night, but ordinarily it would be. And there was also venison, which we enjoyed. Is that local too?
Yes, the venison is from the Yarra Valley. It's a wonderful product, and it's got such a silky texture to the meat, and it's beautifully served rare.
And since you listeners will know that one of the best meals we ever enjoyed was at restaurant Gordon Ramsay in London, where he serves venison with a chocolate and raspberry sauce. And guess what was associated with the venison we had last night? The answer is
chocolate and raspberry sauce.
great minds must think alike, I guess. Matthew, next up, we did talk about... Matthew wasn't here last night, by the way. His brigade did a fantastic job in his absence, as Sue said they would, and it's, they came through. But he knows what we had, so why don't you talk us through a few of the dishes that we enjoyed, just so people can firsthand understand, when I come here, this is what might be on my plate.
Okay, you started with an amuse bouche, which was tuna tartare. Following that, you went into the salmon valentine, which is a herb-crusted poached salmon with cucumber and coconut jelly, lime air, and a crab aioli using fresh local olive oil drizzled on the plate. Then after that, you would have had the quail, which is a boned quail stuffed with foie gras and truffle. With a truffle linguine and sauce perigord. Following that would have been the tempura of soft shell crab, which is a new product in Australia, being soft shell crab.
Now, that's an unusual Australian crab called blue swimmer. Tell us a little, where does that come from? And is there just a specific soft shell season?
There's a new farm started up in Queensland that has perfected the technique of getting the crabs when they shed their shell. And now we used to in this country only buy it in frozen and cryovac. Now we can actually get it fresh, which is fantastic.
Okay, so you can tell how much we enjoyed that, Ann, because Miss Ann just absolutely loves soft shell crabs, and we have them whenever we can get them in season in the U.S., which is not as often as we would like, and not always at the price we would like either. But there was more.
Yeah, the tempura soft shell crab was served with pickled vegetables and a wasabi mayonnaise. Following that, you would have had the pork dish, which is an assiette of pork, slow braised pork cheek, caramelized pork belly, little pork sanchoi bao. And this is utilizing the rare breed black pig.
And then we had a little lamb and then the venison, which is also a local product, I believe.
Yes, that's correct. The lamb's fantastic. It's smoked, served with a pea puree, mint jelly, summer, autumn vegetables, and mint jus.
And we didn't have dessert, but that luxury is certainly available. We were admiring what was on the plates of our neighbors at the table, but on the menu, Fingtao, but we should have had a cheese course, shouldn't we?
Yes, definitely. I do love cheeses. I was recently a judge at the National Cheese Awards, and I like sourcing as many local cheeses as possible. We've got Yarra Valley Dairy down the road, and we try to have as many of their cheeses in different areas on the property, working with them both in the cafe and in Eleanor's. And we do also specialise in some imported cheeses as well. We just try to source what is the best cheese around, particularly.
So I think the answer is this, Matt, if I can summarise it this way. Go on a diet for several days before you get to Shadow Yuring. Remember to commit to a diet in the few days after that as well. And that'll give you a chance to have one of the most excellent country dining experiences in Victoria. Our last thought, Matthew?
Yeah, just make your way out to the Yarra Valley if you can. I think it's a beautiful area. It's beautiful surroundings being in Chateau Yering, in a Relais Chateau. And, yeah, come out and enjoy the cuisine.
Most people think of Australia as sandy beaches, blue ocean, big cities like Sydney and Melbourne and Brisbane and Adelaide and Perth. But there's a whole lot of Australia that's in between. That's where On the Menu is today. Today we're in the country at a place called Chateau Yering, but I'm going to ask General Manager Sue O'Brien to explain to us where we are and what this country experience is all about. Sue?
Thank you, Peter. Well, Chateau Yering is set in the heart of the Yarra Valley, which is a premier wine region for Victoria. The key thing is that it's just 1 hour from Melbourne City. 1 hour's drive and you find yourself in the middle of amazing countryside. We're set on 250 acres of pasture and we are surrounded by vineyards and pasture and really heart of the countryside but an hour from Melbourne. Chateau Yering has a lot of history. It was the site of the first vineyard in Victoria. The first vine planted here was planted in 1838. It's a Sweetwater vine, and we now today have a cafe named Sweetwater. The cellar was built in 1840 and followed by the house being built in 1854 by Paul de Castella, who is a migrant from Switzerland. The house has been a substantial house over the years with a lot of land, and from time to time a little bit was cut off here and there, and in the last time it was subdivided was in 1996. Ending up with two properties, Yering Station, the winery next door, and Chateau Yering, the homestead.
So you really have a chance here to experience what it was like more than 150 years ago in this great down on the continent, right?
Exactly. 150 years for some people isn't a lot, but for Australia it's a long time. The house is heritage listed, as are the gardens. We're very fortunate the hotel is only 10 years old, but the gardens are well over 100 years old.
But there is something else we should mention, because in 1850, this house would not have had air conditioning. It would not have had the same kind of plumbing facilities as we have today. So, listeners, you get both. So you get the wonderful country experience, but at the same time, all the benefits of civilization.
Yes, Mr. and Mrs. Milner, the owners of the property, totally restored the main house. Beautiful high ceilings. They've restored it with rich colours, superb fabrics imported from Europe. They've added on two restaurants and accommodation. And throughout the accommodation and the main house, it feels like you're back in the 1800s, although the quality and the service are today's style in the 21st century.
And we should remind everybody that this was the first property in Australia to join the Relais and Chateau designation, which gives you an idea just exactly what the standards are here, so that you can expect world-class accommodations, wonderful service, a wonderful environment, but at the same time you can sit on the veranda and listen to the birds chattering before they go to sleep, and then when you get up in the morning they're up and about again in the morning welcoming you to the day. And it seems to me like they think they own Chateau Yering and we're just sort of borrowing it.
That's quite right. The property does have double glazing everywhere, even though the only sounds outside are the sounds of the kookaburras and the birds and the kangaroos in the paddocks. But yes, we have been a Relais and Chateau property for 7 years now. We're very proud of that fact, and up until this year, we were the only one in Australia.
But get this, Peter, as those of you know on the menu, Peter, you know that You know that Peter has a cigar habit, but it's absolutely wonderful to sit out on the veranda and watch the countryside and enjoy that. And I did that through the heat of the day yesterday, because temperature-wise, during the day, it can get quite hot here. Yesterday, I think it was in the low 30s centigrade. Today, it's going to be cloudy and cooler. What is the weather experience that people generally are going to have year-round here, Sue?
Melbourne is a great location because we have four seasons. Unlike a lot of other states, we do have the beautiful autumns, the beautiful spring, cold, cold winters and hot summers. In the summer months, the temperatures are usually around the 30 degrees Celsius mark, but can go up to as high as 46. But we are beautifully air-conditioned in Chateau Yering, so it's fine. In the winter, it does get down to below freezing, and we do have some very good frosts. Very occasionally, we might have a little flurry of snow, but not very often, and it certainly doesn't settle.
Now, we met some people last evening who pass by this way a lot, although I think they've not stayed here before. They're on the way to ski Australia. So for those who are interested in the white snow sports, those exist about how much further from here?
My car is about an hour and a half further to the top of the mountain. Mount Buller is our closest mountain. Mount Borbor is also close by. But a lot of people go by helicopter. They pop in here for lunch or for breakfast on their way to the mountain. They spend a day at the mountain and then fly back to Melbourne.
But this area now is perhaps best known as wine country in what's called the Yarra Valley, specializing in rather cool temperature white wines and Pinot Noir. So there are lots and lots of places to go. And one of the Healesville, perhaps Sue, you'd like to mention, there's one sort of major attraction in Healesville. Those of you who have not seen Australia's mammals get a chance to go there.
Absolutely. We are a great food and wine region and can direct our guests to various size wineries, etc. But we always encourage our guests to go to Healesville Sanctuary. It's the best place to see Australian wildlife in their natural habitat. And it's only 15 minutes drive from Chateau Yering. We can also arrange a complimentary guide who can direct you to around the Healesville Sanctuary to see things that you might miss as you're wandering through.
So you can probably guess what On the Menu is up to do today. Well, On the Menu is going to a winery to taste some wine and have lunch. We're going to another winery, and then if all goes well during the rest of the day, Miss Anne wants to go to the Healesville Sanctuary. So we'll try and do everything in one, only because our visit here is all too brief. You should come and plan to spend several days because there are so many alternative things to do. The interesting thing is that we lived in Australia 30 years ago. The one thing we observed is that Melbourne's suburban sprawl has reached within 10 miles of Chateau Yering, but once you're in the country, it doesn't feel like that. It's a real wonderful country experience. A last thought for our listeners, Sue?
Although we're so close to suburbia now with the urban sprawl, we're fortunate to know that the Yarra Valley will remain as it is. There's no more chopping up of land. The vineyards will continue. The beautiful cattle will be grazing. The horse properties will still be there. And Chateau Yering will be right in the middle of all of it. So you're all very welcome to come and visit us at Chateau Yering here in the Yarra Valley. Our website is www.chateauyering.com.au.
Well, it was certainly wonderful. Everyone was they just couldn't have been more talented, efficient, and charming. But let's take a pause now and pay the rent.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
I was all lined up to say welcome back, but Anne said no, she wants to do a poem. So go do a poem, Miss Anne.
I thought that I would never see a sparkling Shiraz. Oh, how could it be?
Matt Steele seems like a very young man to be a winemaker at Domaine Chandon Greenpoint in the Yarra Valley where we are today. But Matt, let our listeners know, where are we in relation to Melbourne and what kind of wine-growing region is this?
Thanks, Peter. We're actually out in the Yarra Valley, which is 50 kilometres east of Melbourne. I guess that's 35 miles or thereabouts. It's a fantastic drive because Melbourne is at the opening of the Yarra Valley, so you can follow the river out. We're a reasonably mountainous little region, a cool climate region that has a long history of producing elegant wines, particularly from Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, which is why we were established here in 1986 to produce sparkling wines initially.
Geographically, listeners, I have to tell you, it's not quite as simple as Matt mentioned, because we drove out here from Melbourne. We missed the freeway we were supposed to get on leaving the city, and we were still in suburban Melbourne until about somewhere between 5 and 10 kilometres away. But now we're looking out over vineyards and mountains as far as the eye can see, and it looks just like a wine place you should grow wine.
Oh, it's a magnificent region. If I had have known a bit earlier, I would have given you a bit of LK, a little bit of local knowledge, and given you some scenic routes to come by. But it's magnificent. The Great Dividing Range, which is the mountain range that divides Australia, it's not that great in altitude, but it's about 3,500 kilometres long. That provides, I guess, a barrier to the southerly winds, and that's why we have a cooler climate here.
So if you were looking at this, listeners, for those of you who have been to California, this is sort of like the Silverado Trail Edge of Napa Valley, and a lot like Sonoma and especially the Alexander Valley, if you're trying to get a picture of what it's like, which means it's a place that looks like you ought to grow grapes, and you do. But you have a specialization here, Matt, that you can tell us about.
We were established by Moët Chandon, so initially we were to produce method-traditional sparkling wines, and indeed we still do. However, since 1991, we've been making our table wines and selling them as Greenpoint table wines, and really it's one of the exciting parts of what we're doing. We make cool climate, elegant wines. They're very expressive, but very soft, and I guess from a consumer point of view, they're new relative to other Australian wines, which can be quite big and rich and hearty, as a restrained, elegant, and I guess they're an easier wine to accompany a meal.
Now, you were telling us earlier that you had a mentor, Brian Crozier, as a mentor who helped you to develop your idea of what your style of winemaking would be like. Is that fair?
I was lucky enough to actually do my apprenticeship for a little over 4 years at the Petaluma Winery in the Adelaide Hills. And Brian's an industry icon. He established Petaluma in 1979 when he was a very brave man. Everyone told him he was mad planting Chardonnay in such a cool area, but he really is a visionary, and I'm very lucky that I still know Brian, still get on very well with him. He barracks for the wrong football team, but I don't mind that. That's his one misgiving.
In fact, you said you were talking to him just yesterday or the day before. And for those of you who are trying to keep track of where he's gone, because he's an icon and a great winemaker, he's doing a couple of things. Perhaps, Matt, you just mentioned those?
Yeah, absolutely. Brian's still got the Tiers property, where he has some very close-planted Chardonnay, high-density Chardonnay, and it's producing some wonderful, iconic wines. And he has the Whalebone Vineyard in Tappa Napa, which is in the southeast of South Australia. And he makes a wonderful Bordeaux blend, red, out of there. I'm not sure if I'm letting any secrets go, but he's got a fantastic property on the southern Fleurieu where he's planted a fair amount of Pinot Noir. So watch out for that in the years to come.
Okay, so let's come back to Domaine Chandon Greenpoint. We just tasted, listeners, more wines than I would care to tell you. But why don't you start us off with the wines and go through them quickly, just the way we tasted them.
Okay, I will be brief. We were originally established as sparkling wine producers, so we started with our flagship wine, which is our Pinot Noir Chardonnay Pinot Meunier Vintage Brut, which has 30 months of yeast age, and it's lovely, soft, vibrant, and complex. And we had our Sparkling Red, which is wonderful, a real Aussie style. This is a wine that if Australians celebrated Thanksgiving, it would be on every table. Then we hit our Chardonnays, and our table wine Chardonnay is very fresh and elegant. So our Yarra Valley Chardonnay, which is made from vineyards around our winery on alluvial soil, so it's a very soft, fresh style, and then our Reserve Chardonnay, which comes from higher altitude vineyards with greater intensity and richness. Then we had two Pinot Noir wines, our Pinot Noir Rosé, which is vibrant and fresh and very dry, and our Victorian Pinot Noir, which is a very soft, supple, elegant wine, a real wine that makes your mouth water and really is a lovely wine to enjoy with Japanese food, we found. We finished with two cool climate Shiraz. The Victorian region where we're located has wonderful sub-regions that produce tremendous Shiraz, but not your typical Aussie Shiraz. It's very fresh, very vibrant, but very soft in the mouth. So our Victorian blend is elegant and restrained, and then our Reserve, which is a blend just from the Yarra Valley, has a little more intensity and richness, but lovely spicy characters. So that was our little tasting over the last, you know, 20 minutes or so.
Anne was fascinated by your anthropomorphic descriptions of the different grape varieties. So you said Viognier is lazy. So give us some other examples of what you've learned in terms of how to label different grapes.
I need to clarify why I think Viognier is lazy. It's a variety that when you make wine from it is rather talented. It's almost like that laconic star sportsman that doesn't have to go to training. It really does stand out in any blend that you use it in. However, in the vineyard, it really doesn't want to grow very well. Its shoots don't get very long. They flop over and the sun gets into the fruit too much. So you really have to work very hard to get it to its potential. Pinot Noir can be similar. And even the different clones have different personalities. We have two clones here that we mainly use. One we call Droopy and one we call Upright. Now, the Droopy clone is awesome to make our table wines. The shoots flop over. And thereby you get more sunlight into the fruiting zone, so you get greater intensity of colour and richness. The Upright clone, which is actually a Davis cultivar from Davis in California, is fantastic for making our sparkling wines because the leaves, that grows bolt upright and the leaves protect the fruit from the sun. So these different personalities really do lend themselves to the wines that we make from them.
Yeah, Anne wanted to ask, is there a sort of a wallflower grape?
Oh, there's precious winemakers. I don't know if there's too many precious grape varieties. So, yes, Pinot Noir is a bit of a prima donna. And Sauvignon Blanc's bombastic and out there. What you see on the grape in terms of flavours on the vine, you definitely get in the glass. So, yeah, everything has its own personality, and it's great fun working with all these different varieties.
Well, listeners, if you can find a way, which on the menu did not, even though Peter rates himself as a being good direction finder, he got lost. It really is only about an hour from the center of Melbourne to get here. It's a delightful region. It was our first stop. We're looking out across vines growing with roses along the end of the row and the muddy old Yarra River in the center of everything. This is about as bucolic as it gets, 50 kilometers from Melbourne. And if you have the chance to come and meet Chef Matt, I mean, winemaker Matt, I promise you'll have a wonderful time.
Yeah, I'd certainly like to extend an invitation to all your listeners, Peter. It's worth the day in a plane. And, you know, we've all had trips that are a day and you're disappointed, but this is one that I guarantee you'll enjoy yourselves.
Like most Australian wineries with a cellar door, the Domaine Chandon Green Point property has an excellent lunchtime-only restaurant where we enjoyed lunch as we sampled some of Matt's wonderful wines. And the next place, that was equally true. And there's an even third dimension, because it's not just wine, not just lunch, but also art. But we'll have our host at Tarawarra Wines and the Tarawarra Art Museum explain all that.
Sometimes I think we overuse the word unique at On the Menu. But we do get to go to some rather special places. And, of course, we found another one today. And it means slow water, a bend in the Yarra River where our host Simon Napthine says the original Victorian Aboriginals used to catch eels, presumably because at that point they couldn't swim away. But that's got nothing to do with it except that it's a place where there is an intersection of fine wine and fine art. Simon, explain a little bit about this concept called Tarawarra.
Yes, it really is a magical sense of place that we have here. And it was from the Wurundjeri, which were the traditional owners of this land. And we are at the foothills of the Great Dividing Range, the foothills of our Victorian Alps. As the valley starts to move out and the Yarra then starts to wind its way through to Melbourne. And so we have a wonderful confluence of events going on here in terms of our climate, because we're moving from sort of maritime to continental. We've got our beautiful hills in the background, which also define our terroir. And we also have that ability to have a lot of things, as you say, intersect. Our ambitions with food and wine, the art collection that we have, and in the neighbouring Tarawarra Museum of Art. And it really does make for a great region, and the Yarra Valley is a wonderful winemaking community to be part of.
Now, the whole venture was founded by a family who did something else altogether, correct?
Correct. The property is owned by the Beeson family, who made their money in Australia through fashion retailing and also through a number of significant retail property developments. And as Mr. Beeson Mark Beeson Sr., says that it's enabled them to have the money to indulge their passions, which one of them being art and the other being great wine.
And you got here by a somewhat circuitous route through the world of higher education and then your career. Tell us a little bit about that. It's really a rather fascinating story.
Yes, and this story is, I think, a typical Melbourne experience in that I was a country boy who came to Melbourne to study and then was doing a law degree, found that I wanted to move on and do something different to that, so I actually joined a Catholic monastery for a little while. When I came out of that, I went back to do some more university studies and walked into a good restaurant in Melbourne that I knew of and offered, said, look, I'm willing to learn to be a waiter to pay my way through university. And they asked me, have I drunk wine before? And I said, oh, I think I've drunk a couple of German Hocks, you know, so just some pretty austere wines. And they took me on, and one of my training sessions was after one night of work, they said, if you're going to enjoy wine, start with something good. And I remember it was a bottle of Chateau Versailles Saint-Emilion, beautiful Bordeaux, and it changed my life. I found I started to skip classes to work more shifts in the restaurant, and next thing you know, I'm working as a sales rep for a wine company, doing country runs, driving 600 miles to sell bottles of fine wine to one little store in far western Victoria, and then moved from there into other parts sort of as a marketing manager, and then got approached to manage a small winery on the Mornington Peninsula. And I've been around Melbourne now in the wine trade for about 20 years, always working with our small boutique wineries, which have an affinity and relationship with our Melbourne restaurants. It's a beautiful sort of community where we bounce forth back and forth ideas.
So the label Tarawara, listeners, is one you're more likely to find on a restaurant wine menu than you are in a wine retail store, correct?
Correct. We do a lot of work with our Melbourne and Sydney restaurants. And have very good relationships. For example, we have a sommelier from one of our leading restaurants, Beaudemont, coming out here next week to help us work vintage. And it affects how we make our wines. Our winemaker, Bruce and Claire and myself, we like dining at these restaurants. We get feedback from them. We like the fine structured food. So that affects what wines we're going to make, and it brings that sensibility to that winemaking process, which is great. It really does make us part of a, like I said, a community. You know, I think that's an important thing.
So you're making a variety of different quality levels. You're working with the great portfolio that's available in Victoria, but you're making wines that go with food?
Absolutely. We are making wines which have a savouriness and a character about them. Our two main wines that we're known for mostly in Australia and most of our estate is planted out to is Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. We're trying to make in those, we make sort of two different cuvées, our sort of entry-level cuvée, which we call Tin Cows after a group of sculptures we have in our property, and our reserve cuvée. And with both of those, we're trying to give them a beautiful plushness of flavour in terms of some fruit character, but give them time in bottle so that they can develop some additional character and have some additional finesse. Our reserve Chardonnay that we've just released is our 2005. So it's already been in bottle for 2 years after being in oak for 12 months. It's had time to evolve on its own. We haven't had to create that character. It's given it time to evolve. And we think our Chardonnays can evolve for up to 10 years. And as a result, they are beautiful food wines.
Now, we've read that Australia's been having some climatic difficulties over the last several years. What does that mean to listeners about vintages that they should that you think are the really excellent ones that they should look out for on restaurant wine menus?
This is one of those great hard questions, because for every rule there's an exception, and on my first piece of advice is that go to a restaurant with a good sommelier so they should know, and if they don't, demand why they don't know. In our particular set of circumstances, I'll talk about the 2007 vintage, because that was the worst vintage you'd want to ever have. And it was brought about by our drought that we're experiencing in climate change. We are a cool climate area, so we do have enough water. Drought doesn't affect us in terms of vines dying or lack of growth that way. But what it did mean is we had very dry soils, and beautiful fine spring weather in October 2006 leading into the 2007 vintage. And we got really severe frosts. We lost in one night two-thirds of our entire production, which is heartbreaking. So then we're going along struggling with the other third of the crop, and the dry weather led to over summer and into the hills I was talking about, which are the ranges behind us, massive bushfires where I believe they have burnt out over 1 million hectares. I'm sorry, I can't convert that into acres, but I think that would probably be about 2.5 million acres of bushland. That created a massive smoke pall that actually came into our vineyard where we couldn't see one end of the vineyard from the other. And that actually created a phenomenon called smoke taint, where the actual grape skins pick up some of the aromas and flames of the smoke. So our unoaked whites, like Sauvignon Blanc, were fine, but all our Pinot Noir we effectively declassified and made it into our rosé, which we really like, because we were able to press it off the skin straight away and have no skin contact. So that's the worst it can be. Other years will vary between being slightly cooler and slightly warmer around a medium. And that can have different things. So, for example, in 2005, our Chardonnays were beautiful. One of our Chardonnays in the number of our wine critics in Australia has been ranked as the highest pointed Chardonnay in Australia. Conversely, our Pinot Noirs that year had nice Beaumé and ripeness, but they really lacked an extra intensity that we really want. And so we declassified all our reserve material that year.
So you have to stay a little bit on your toes, but as Simon was suggesting, you meet a sommelier, you'll know if you come to the winery, Simon or one of his team will be able to help you. We were also talking a little bit ago about, shall we say, the bullshit factor in the vocabulary that wine lovers use to describe their wine. And you said something very interesting and suggest that we just need to capture.
Yeah, we were having a conversation enjoying one of our Pinot Noirs here, and I was talking about its character and saying, you know, about its length, and in some ways certain wines could be quite linear, etc. And we started talking about vocabulary. And I have a theory that one of the dangers of winemaking science is that it can become very reductive, that we try and spend our whole time dividing things into components. So we spend our whole time saying it has hints of this elder flower or this berry or that juniper or this or that, as if we can, the person who produces the biggest list of components has tasted the wine better than anyone else. My view on that is wine is about the whole. Wine is about the experience. So what I talk to sommeliers about is I want them to describe what we're experiencing. Is it plush and full and rich on the palate? Does it have great length and liveliness? They're the things which will make your palate react to different dishes and different foods. I'm not really interested so much in does it have a hint of persimmon as a hint of cardamom. I more want to know about how it feels in my mouth and the flavour and structure that way. And I think that's how I like to talk about wine.
So does it smell good? Does it taste good? What does it go with?
Correct. And how's it reacting to my mouth? I use the example of all the time when talking about Australia's great young Rieslings. What's so great about them is what the acid, how lively and fresh they feel on the tongue. And what I say to people is they smell a little bit of citrus and lemon, and they have this liveliness of citrus and lemon. What do you do with citrus and lemon? You squeeze them on beautiful pieces of grilled fish. Hello, this is what makes Riesling the perfect thing for our beautiful fresh white fish in Australia. That's how I like to approach wines and think about them.
Makes a lot of sense to me. So let's just conclude, if we can, with the website where people can find out more.
Our website is named after our region and our winery. It's www.tarawarra.com.au. We are in Australia, so remember the .au.
And there are lots of R's in there, so it's TARRARA, just for those people who might not realize consonants have to be repeated in this part of the world. Simon, thank you so much for being our host and for talking to us today.
Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure. And I have to say, the conversations we had were superb.
And that seems a good point to take another pause for the cause.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
There's probably no better place to conclude our coverage of our visit to Victoria than the place where wine growing actually started in this state. And we had the opportunity to meet someone whose family has been involved in this for generation after generation.
Anne says this is not a good day for Peter because he keeps on getting our guest's name wrong, but I'll do it right this time. It's Alistair Purbrick of Tarbilk Vineyards on a bend in the Goulburn River. This is as bucolic as it gets, listeners. And the wonderful part about it is this is the place where the very first vines were planted in the state of Victoria. Right, Alistair?
That's correct. In fact, we still have some of those original vines planted. They survived phylloxera, planted in 1860. They're Shiraz vines. And those grapes are kept separate, and we keep them for what we call our highest priced and our flagship wine. And it's just a very rare release. Only 200 cases made each year.
And of course, Anne and Peter got to sample some, and we loved it. And we think it's a wonderful thing that's happening. But this is about all in the family, because Alistair's Purbrink family took over the vineyard when?
The family took over the vineyard in 1925. My great-grandfather, Reginald Purbrick, bought the property. But we can trace our involvement with Tarbilk back to 1875, when Reginald's third cousin actually excavated that particular cellar. So although we can't trace ownership right back to the very beginning, it's sort of nice that we can trace family involvement right back to those times.
Now, this chateau word is a sort of a controversial thing. You mentioned just a bit ago, because somebody gave the property that name a long time ago before you owned it. And then you said recently you decided to get rid of it. But the word does have an association that's interesting when you go below ground. In Australia, there are cellars which are at the ambient temperature of a cellar underground in Australia. So that's a sort of a Frenchy thing, isn't it?
Well, having underground cellars is certainly very European. But having a name when you're proudly Australian, which has got a French generic name in the word chateau hanging off it, sort of made us uncomfortable back in the 1990s. And so we decided at the turn of the century, in the year 2000, to drop the word chateau and go back to what actually was the original name of the winery. It was originally called Tarbilk Estate or Tarbilk Vineyards. We're now back to that. So we've returned to our roots, so to speak.
Now, the first vines planted were the 1860, or was there some before that?
No, the first vines were planted in 1860, and it's just this very small patch, this 1.5 acre patch of Shiraz vines that are left from those days.
So let's, before we forget, let's point out to listeners that if they get a chance at the top label wines that you're producing, which are still out there, they should certainly chase it down. They should certainly enjoy. So the three wines that we tasted at the end of our tasting, Alistair, were which ones?
The current release of our three reserve red wines, the 2002 Eric Stevens Purbrick Shiraz, which is made from vines planted in the 1930s, the 2002 Eric Stevens Purbrick Cabernet Sauvignon, which is made from vines planted in 1948, and of course the wine that we've been talking about, the 2002 1860 vine Shiraz, planted obviously in 1860.
Now, you don't have a secret project called Alistair Purbrick Vines by any chance that are going to be coming up soon?
I don't have a secret project like that, but we do have a secret project which involves the 1860 vines. About 7 years ago, we took cuttings from those vines, and the reason we did that was because we were concerned that those gracious old ladies would ultimately die from old age, but we didn't want to lose that particular clone of Shiraz. So we planted those vines, and we've had three crops from those younger vines now, and the fruit quality looks outstanding. So So if ultimately those 1860 planted vines die and leave us, at least we'll have the clone, and hopefully the clone will be quite old by then.
Now you're producing two very interesting white wines that are non-Australian typical, and that again, on the menu, family members, you should look out for, because they're unusual for an Australian winemaker and excellent wines in their own right, even if they were not just interesting and unusual.
We have a love affair here at Tobilk with Rhone varietals. So certainly we've talked about Shiraz. The three white Rhone varietals are Marsan, Roussan and Viognier. And it's the Marsan and the Viognier that we're particularly pleased with here, that it grows very well in our climate. And with Marsan, the oldest vines date back to 1927, which are older than any Marsan vines that you'll find in the Côte de Rhône, which is a nice thing for an Australian company to be able to say. And our Viognier vines, though, are much younger, planted in the late 1980s. And again, a variety. They're both unoaked wines, and two varieties that we think we can do very well in this part of the world, and which are both available in America.
So there's wide distribution. Those OTM listeners here or in Australia, you can join the Tobilk Wine Club and join the
other members that are now around 30,000 strong.
So if you're here, you better get in on this, because you do something very unusual. You don't just release the new vintage. You've also told us that you've held back from previous vintages so that there's a way of getting already matured Tobilk wines, correct?
We try and make the offering to our wine club members as diverse as we possibly can. So part of that is holding back vintages of particularly red wines and Marsan, and allowing our wine club members to access those wines on occasion, and they might be able to access wines that are 25 and 30 years old. And we also have planted on the estate a number of other esoteric and different varieties, which we bottle in small quantities, and we also make those wines available to our wine club members.
But for the majority of On the Menu listeners who are in the Americas and in Europe, there's a range of wines available. Can you just quickly mention what those are?
The range that we have available nationally in Australia and internationally in the whites is Marsan and Viognier. With our reds, it's a Shiraz and a Cabernet Sauvignon. Then we go to the ESP, the Eric Stevens Per Brick Shiraz and Cabernet Sauvignon. And finally, the highest priced wine is the 1860 Vines Shiraz.
Well, I will begin by saying that I find these wines so elegant and so appealing. I could just rave about them. No palate fatigue here, listeners, which you might be accustomed to with like big ass Shirazes and whatnot. But I wanted you also, because this is such a special property, to tell us a little bit about the wetlands of reclamation.
The wetlands project started 12 years ago. And we have allowed around 1,000 acres of land to go back to God, back to its original, close to pristine condition, by allowing the water to return into a lot of what were blocked lagoons and billabongs, and we might have to talk to people about what that means. And then we allowed 10 years for all of the indigenous plants to naturally revegetate throughout this area. Then 2 years ago, we opened that up to the public. We have two boats, 30-seater boats, and people can take an hour cruise around the wetlands, and at times they can get off at three designated points and do some walks, some eco trails, anything from a 20-minute walk to a two-hour walk. So it's a very big, extensive area. Then after doing all that exercise, if you're hungry, we've got our new wetlands cafe sitting high, looking over all the wetlands area, so you can get out on the balcony and enjoy the view and hopefully enjoy some nice food.
And if unlike on the menu, because Peter was behind the wheel today and he got lost on the way here, it truly is about an hour and 20 minute ride from the Melbourne Central Business District, and very accessible also from the Melbourne Airport. So if you want a bucolic country experience before you get involved in metropolitan Victoria, it would be a great place to start off. It feels like the end of the road, because the road does end at Chateau Tarbilk, with a fascinating looking building. How would you describe the building when to someone who was looking for it and hadn't seen it before?
That's a tough question. I guess if you could imagine a pagoda, Chinese pagoda style building, that's sort of the look of it. And if you buy one of our wines, then that particular tower is actually on our label, on every Tarbilk label. That's about the best description of it, I think.
But we can't call it the chateau anymore, so what do we call it?
I'll have to leave that to everyone's imagination.
It's just the building. If you want to get a flavor of it, those of you who went to the Napa Valley when the Napa Valley was a place to visit because not so many people went there, it's, to me, although it's small, it's reminiscent of what the old Inglenook used to look like before Francis Ford Coppola bought it and made it into his house. So this is a great destination. We're just so delighted that we took the time to come here. And Alistair, we thank you for your hospitality. Do you have a final thought? Imagine that you're talking to people who might be interested in Tarbilk wines throughout the world. What would you like to say to them?
As far as Tarbilk's concerned, I think what it represents in Australia is to visit the winery is a step back in time. What we've really, really try and achieve is to keep the winery as authentic as we possibly can. So it might be a little bit dilapidated around the edges and a little bit worn and weary because we're about to celebrate our 150th anniversary, but hopefully when you visit, and I would urge you all to make your way to Melbourne and out to Tarbilk, hopefully you'll feel like you've stepped back in time to the 1860s and 1870s. That's what we're trying to achieve. Hopefully we do.
You do, and listeners, you just got to come here. Right, Miss Anne?
Yes, we have a website for you.
Yes, our website is www.tarbilk.com.au, and there's lots of information there. There's lots of photographs. And if you need, or anyone, any of the listeners need more information, then you can email us. All that detail is there as well. More than happy to send absolutely anything that you need, even if it's things like labels for label collections and so on. All that can be done.
Alistair, thank you so much for your hospitality, and now it's to the Wetlands Cafe.
And indeed, it was to the Wetlands Cafe for a fast bite of lunch and then
it was wonderful.
And we had a rather rapid drive because we had to get back to the Tullamarine Airport in Melbourne because we were flying off to South Australia, and we asked how long it took, and it took every minute of the time that they had said it would, and I was actually starting to get a little worried that we might be rushing for our plane, but we made it on schedule, just like we made it through this program on schedule.
And that's I'm exhausted all over again.
But we hope we'll see you same time, same place next week at On the Menu Radio.
Bye-bye.